Recording in progress.
Let me welcome colleagues from National Treasury. I'm not sure if the Deputy Minister is here, Momo, the acting DG, and the entire team from SARS and other entities of that reports to National Treasury. All our stakeholders who are in attendance, the media, the parliamentary support team, and all of you who are in attendance, you are all welcome. Let's move faster because we have quite a long agenda today. Today's business is the response by National Treasury and SARS to submissions received on the draft TILAB and the draft TALAB. The meeting is officially open. Do we have apologies? Response by National Treasury and SARS. Who's leading with the responses? Over to you, National Treasury and SARS.
No, thank you, Chair. I'm just undergoing load shedding, and there's a generator behind me, so I'll just start, but I'll get the team to take over. But before I do, so morning to honourable members and Chair. I just wanted to introduce, I don't know if she's been introduced, Ms. Makoshi Lakete, who's the acting, she is a DDG, but she's acting as DDG of Tax and Financial Sector Policy, my previous job, for at least 6 months. So I just wanted to introduce her. She is, I think, present today with us. I don't know, Makoshi, if you can put your camera on as well. But I'm just going to come in on specific issues on these slides. Next slide, please. So, Chair, I think, you know, as you know, this is a kind of ritual we have to do every year. With the tax laws, like with the appropriation and other acts or bills before Parliament with the budget. These are the bills that we do with the budget. And I think as we outline, they contain the remainder of the laws today. Yesterday, you dealt with the rates bill and the retirement laws amendment bill. The tax laws amendment bill and the tax administration laws amendment bill deal now with the remaining budget proposals, particularly in Annexure C. They were published for comment on the 29th July. And I think as we pointed out, we have to split the bills into an administrative portion, which is the admin bill, the TALAB, and into the money bill, which is in terms of Section 77 of the Constitution. The closing date for comments were the end of August, and we briefed the committee on the 23rd of August, and we've also had selective workshops with stakeholders once we received their comments to try and process those as well. So today we present to the committee. I'm going to ask Yanga or Chris to take over. In the meanwhile, I'll come in on just some of the sections, Chair. Just because of load shedding, it's a bit difficult to run this, but I do want the team to run it. I'll just stay in the background, and I'll come in just on the issues around the carbon tax. Thank you. Yanga, are you going to take over? Yeah.
Yes, Momo. Thank you very much. Good morning, honorable members. As Momo has indicated, we are doing a response based on public hearings on 14, as well as on workshops that were held both on 8th and 9th of September. As Momo indicated, this is a draft response document. What is going to happen? We will do changes in the bill before the bill is tabled by the minister. So this is a draft response. This response will be final after the bill has been tabled. We're not going to go through to the table of contents, but the first item on the draft TLEP is vaping, electronic nicotine and non-nicotine delivery system. Over to you, Mpho. Thank you.
Sorry, if I may just come in, Chair, maybe just to expand on what Yanga says. So this is a draft response from Treasury. We present it to the committee, and obviously the committee makes the decisions, and then we adjust before we do the revised bill that the minister will table. So that's just the process. So this is the Treasury response, what Parliament decides, or what the Standing Committee decides today. Over to you, Mpho.
Thanks, Momo. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Members. I'll just quickly go through the comments that we have received on the electronic nicotine and non-nicotine delivery systems. In the 2022 budget, the Minister made an announcement with regards to the implementation of a flat excise duty of 2.90 per milligram, regardless of the nicotine content of the solution, to be implemented January 2023. And we had further consultations with WISPARS, and in the TLEP, the date for implementation has been moved to June of 2023. In terms of the comments that we have received, there's concern around the proposed text that it was excessive and it will potentially affect the trade of all legitimate tax-paying vendors, and therefore will have the potential to lead to reduction in incomes and income generation and VAT and all the possibly lead to further job losses. We partially accept that the imposition of the tax obviously will is an imposition on business, and therefore it will have that impact because it's an imposition. However, we feel that the imposition of the tax is necessary because the ends are currently unregulated, and there's a regulatory a gap that needs to be managed, because right now they are untaxed and need to be taxed for health reasons. Also, there was concern around the excise duty will be ineffective in terms of achieving the intended purpose. We don't accept that it do not achieve the intended purpose, because the intention of the tax is to reduce consumption and also look at the long-term health effects of this product. There is consensus that even though these products are marketed as less harmful compared to cigarettes and or traditional tobacco products, they are not without risk, and therefore they need to be included in the tax net as we take a cautionary approach, and then we don't think the delay in the implementation of the tax will be helpful in this regard. There was also the view that that this product smoking cessation tools for adults wishing to quit. And we don't accept that, because these products are not recognized and approved as estimation tools. The World Health Organization doesn't recognize this as tobacco cessation rules, even in tools, and even in the U.S. the U.S. Food and Drug Administration doesn't recognize them as cessation tools. Again, in the report of the United States Surgeon General of 2022 concluded that there is no evidence, conclusive evidence, to say this product are cessation tools. So we don't accept that they are cessation tools. And with regards to the comments on the excise structure and the duty rate that we have received, there were comments to say that the current proposed rate of R2.90 per milliliter is too low, considering that in the market you have products that are coming in at around two mils or low volume, and therefore the tax incidence on those will be quite low and not have an impact. And the suggestion was that we should consider imposing a R5 per mil to have an impact at those low volume per product. And again, the suggestion was that we should have as a minimum of R50 per unit that is sold, because most of those will be closed products. We know the comments. The current proposed rate is an introductory rate, and that will be monitored as the tax is implemented, and the necessary adjustments will be made, and that will be the decision that the Minister of Finance will make. And again, there was opposition on the rate, the tax as it is proposed. We know the opposition, but in terms of the proposed rate that is implemented on on this end, we looked at what is implemented in other countries, and we think that the rate of R2.90 per mil is comparable to what is implemented elsewhere. That table just shows the list of the countries that we looked at, and also looking at the conversion rate, and it gives an indication of where those rates are compared to what we are proposing, and we think our rate is comparable. Again, the were proposals around the structure of the proposed rate, that it should be changed to look at a separate rate that will be applicable to low volume products, those below 2 milliliter, to apply a certain rate and another rate for volumes higher than 2 milliliters, and that was based on the work that was done by Oxford Economics, and then they proposed that the rate that I mentioned there above of the 70 rand for or 70 cents per mil for over 2 mil, and a flat rate for those that are below of 92 cents. We know the issue around this proposal, but again, when we proposed the flat rate of 2.90 per mil, we took into consideration the issue around the complexity of implementing be it a two-tier, because in our original proposal, we're also looking at taxing this product based on nicotine and volume, and the comments that we received was that we should be looking at a simplified system. That's why, therefore, the this proposal around the two-tier concern about the complication that it will bring into the system. Also, there was concern that the current proposal just looks purely or is based purely on volume, and therefore it is not accepted. But again, the issue is that in the original discussion paper, we had a proposal to text based on nicotine content and also on volume. It was a two-tier system, but again, from the comments we have received was that is going to complicate the administration of the system. Therefore, the proposal was that we should have a flat rate. That's why we have that flat rate that the minister proposed in the 2022 budget. Again, there were issues that were raised around the administration of this system. Here, the issue was that the vaping market is extremely fragmented, and therefore it will be complex to administer, and therefore there will be a high risk of fiscal evasion. We note the concerns that have been raised. But SARS as the implementing agency will be putting measures around the licensing and registration of taxpayers, and also looking at enforcement around the implementation of this proposal. And again, SARS has made commitment around detecting the taxpayers who are non-compliant, and also enforcing the legislation to make sure that all taxpayers are compliant. And also there was a concern around the robust anti-illicit trade framework that needs to be implemented to make sure that all the the importers and manufacturers are licensed, and again the issues around the manufacturing sites and then bonded warehouse, and that there is traceability of the products that are traded. We know that, and SARS will also be looking at that in terms of implementing the administrative regime for this tax. And again, there were issues around. Also on the administration of the excise, to say that an electronic track and trace system should be implemented so that we were able to deal with the issues of illicit trade. We note the comment, the Department of Health is leading government with regards to the ratification of the World Health Organization protocol on eliminating illicit trade in tobacco products. And once that South Africa ratifies that, will be required to implement a track and trace system. And this system basically will be used on or applied to other to all other accessible products. So this ends will also be part of that system. Again, there's an issue that the current products on the market, they are labeled or based on puffs and not on milliliters. Therefore, the exercise that you implemented on non-milliliters might be problematic. That we should be looking at mandatory labeling of this. The Department of Health is busy with legislation to regulate this product, and that include the empowers the Minister of Health to make regulations for on number of issues on the sector. And then again, the concern around public consultation around the administration of the system, and as we had indicated that the postponement to June next year was based on consultation with SARS in terms of providing sufficient time for administrative process to to be implemented, and that will still happen. And the issue around illicit trade was the concern was that there's quite a lot of self mix in the market. Government is also concerned around the illicit trade because it undermines public health and health of objectives, and measures will be put in place to strengthen enforcement around that. But again, with all the efforts, if there are people with criminal intent, that maybe is something else. But I think from an administration, everything will be done to make sure that compliance is achieved. Thank you very much.
Okay, so it's the carbon tax. Chair, Okay, Chair, let me start off. Chris, I don't know, is Charlene here?
Good morning, Momo. I'm here.
Okay.
You just cut off. Thanks.
Okay. Let me just start off. Chair, I noted with some concern some of the responses to the carbon tax, and I thought just to provide some context would be important. This is probably the longest consulted text, certainly in recent history. We first proposed the idea of a carbon tax in 2010, and we had intended to implement it in 2015, and it really took a number of years of deep consultation. And let me add that, whenever there is a tax that applies to business, we don't expect business to welcome any tax increase, just as we don't expect business to object when we lower a tax rate like we did with the corporate income tax rate was reduced by 1%. A business will certainly not complain. And so when you have a tax increase and you get the kind of strong response from business, you really wonder, is business going to act beyond what I call a turkey? You don't consult a turkey for Christmas, in the sense that if you're increasing the tax, we expect what the answer is. But they're attempting to understand what's the challenges we're trying to face on climate change and their own commitments about how they're going to emit less carbon over the next 10, 15 years. So I was rather surprised at the lack of vision, frankly, coming from many of the businesses. And can I say that a lot of what's said is also something they wouldn't say to their investors when they face overseas, when they have the annual meetings and they've asked to put their plans on how they themselves are going to emit less carbon going into the future. And so, Chair, when you look at the carbon tax, it forms an integral part of the climate change response of our country, and it's linked to the national climate change. Well, it was first produced in as part of the climate change response policy, the NCCRP of 2011, and was also proposed by the National Development Plan. So, as I said, it took over 10 years to develop. There was exhaustive and extensive consultations. And I should add that to the point as well that we have many, many exemptions. A company can get up to 95% exemptions on their emissions. And I should add, too, that the tax doesn't apply to all companies. It applies to what we call Scope 1 emitters. Shalin can give you the exact number, but I think it's about 400-plus companies. And so, if anything, the criticism against South Africa was that there's too many exemptions and the rate is far, far too low. And this is one tax where the path to the future is clear, that as we, when we first introduced it, in a sense in 2010, it was a signal to businesses that you've got to start changing towards cleaner technologies, and you've got 10 years or so to do so, so that by now we would expect that many companies have already begun to long implement their own change in their approach, in their technology. In other words, there's behavioral change. So, if you take the many, many consultations, even when we had the carbon tax bill, there were at least 2 to 3 rounds of consultation. The initial draft for the bill was in November 2015. The second, we took comments, we came out with a new version in August 2017. And the 2018 carbon tax bill, which was finally presented to Parliament and adopted and enacted into law in 2019. So, as I said, we always warn, unlike other of the major taxes where the hope is that over time there's a reduction because there's good growth in the economy, this is one tax where we say, look, we actually hope we don't raise much money because companies have learned not to emit as much greenhouse gases and therefore they don't pay the tax. And secondly, that to the extent that the tax is there, that there's going to be a steep increase in the rate. And yes, down the line, although we don't do so now, to reduce the exemptions and the allowances. We don't do that this time yet. But we wanted to give some certainty to companies that, whereas we started at $12 a ton of emissions, and Sharon will show these to you. You know, we are lagging far behind what's expected at $20 at the very least to $50 as you get to 2030 and higher. So depending what type of country you deem to be an advanced economy or an emerging economy. So we obviously have lower targets, but we are far below where we should be. Obviously, we've also committed to the 2015 Paris Agreement. We have our nationally determined commitments. And all in all, taking into account our state of development, it was introduced at a very low rate. And with significant tax-free emission allowances, as I said, it could of at least 60%, but it could go up to 95% to allow our emitting companies to transition their operations and move towards more energy efficiency, renewables, and low carbon tax measures. Next slide, please. So, Chair, I'll ask Charlene just to explain how this slide works, because Charlene has stayed the course and mothered and fathered this book. So let her go through how it works. And I think it's important to understand how it works, because as I said, one needs to look at the incentive. And that's why I was really disappointed that I was hoping that business would come and show leadership, and rather than kind of almost have a turkey effect that they were coming on to. And that's not to say, Chair, some of the assumptions, in fact, in their haste to criticize, they were making assumptions like, one, they seem to be still assuming they'd be emitting the same volume often of emissions in 10 years' time that they compared to today. If they don't have a path to reduce their emissions, they will pay a higher tax at a higher rate. That's the idea. That's the objective of the tax. Secondly, they assume that all the allowances will be taken away, and that's also not correct. And whilst we do think some allowances will be reviewed over time, because we don't want to reward those that refuse to reduce their emissions or change to cleaner technology, still need to pay the price. And here, I want to hasten to add, we're not moving towards zero emissions. We're moving towards the emissions that's in terms of the NDC, the nationally determined commitments that we've submitted in terms of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. But Charlotte, do you want to explain the slide? And perhaps you can explain most of the slides. I might come in here and there on the slides. Thanks.
Thanks, Momo. Good morning, Chair, and good morning, honorable members. So as Momo has said, this tax has been part of an extensive consultation process. And as part of those discussions, it was balancing the objectives around having a tax that's high enough to stimulate those changes, as well as to, as part of the transition, manage the impacts or potential impacts on households and industry competitiveness. So the design of the tax, initially, we started off at a very low rate of around 120 Rand per ton carbon dioxide equivalent in 2019, and then this was adjusted annually, and currently it's around 144 Rand per ton CO2 equivalents. But coupled with this this rate, the tax provides a range of tax-free allowances and exemptions that's aimed to assist sectors to transition. So there's a basic tax-free allowance of 60% that applies to all total greenhouse gas emissions of any company that's subject to the carbon tax currently. To take into account that there may be concerns around competitiveness, there's a dedicated tax-free allowance for trade-exposed sectors of up to a maximum of around 10%. There's also an allowance, a dedicated allowance, to take into account the those sectors where it is hard to abate. And due to the chemistry of their processes, those emissions would happen. And this includes processes like the iron and steel, cement sector. So there's a specific 10% allowance for this, for process emissions, as well as fugitive emissions from mining. And then to encourage companies to actually reduce their carbon intensity of production, which is emissions per ton of their products over time, there is a performance allowance of 5% that they can qualify for, and the allowance is calculated relative to them performing better than a sector benchmark. We also provided a 5% allowance for carbon budgets. So the Department of Environment, of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment, has implemented a voluntary carbon budget system for the period, I think it was from around 2017. And that was extended to the end of this year, 2022. So companies that voluntarily participate in that system, submit information to the department, they qualify for a 5% tax-free allowance. And then lastly, to provide flexibility to companies to transition and to reduce their emissions, we provide a carbon offset allowance ranging from around 5 to 10%. So overall, the maximum allowances that the energy sector would qualify for electricity-related emissions is 90%. So basically, only 10% of the emissions are subject to the tax, and the process emitters, which is the hard-to-abate sectors, as well as some of the fugitive emissions, qualify for a 95% tax-free allowance. The effective rate of this tax is very low, currently ranging from around 6 to 50 Rand, with probably an average of around 34 Rand per ton CO2 equivalent. To help sectors as well transition in terms of the indirect impacts that they would face from this tax due to electricity sector emissions being taxed, we committed to what we call electricity price neutrality So electricity generators, which includes Eskom, as well as electricity generators in the manufacturing industries, can basically offset any payment of their current electricity generation levy, as well as any purchases of renewable electricity against their carbon tax liability. So effectively, at this stage, the tax on electricity related to emissions is zero and there's no pass-through. So that's essentially the design of the tax. We can move to the next slide, please. Okay. So we thought we'd just give some background again in terms of the policy context around climate change and where we are in 2022. We are in a different place now than we were in 2010. In 2010, countries were not required to take on, developing countries were not required to take on a specific emission reduction targets. However, in 2015, under the Paris Agreement, a system around countries pledging the amount of emissions that they would reduce was implemented, and South Africa signed up to the Paris Agreement, and we submit five-yearly nationally determined contribution commitments, which states how we plan to reduce our emissions over time. So we submitted the second NDC for the period 2021 to 2025, and then for the period 2026 to 2030, towards the end of last year, as part of the COP26 process. And for the period 2026 to 2030, we've committed that our emissions would peak in 2025 and then decline significantly from 2026 to 2030. It is expected that the big emission reductions that would be achieved in that period would be from the electricity sector, but providing for other sectors to also start that transition. So these commitments make sure that we are aligned with the 2-degree temperature goal under the Paris Agreement, but also to pursue efforts to achieve the 1.5-degree temperature goal under the Paris Agreement. We are also in the process of processing the National Climate Change Bill, which has been introduced in the National Assembly and has been subject to public consultations with the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment and the Portfolio Committee. As part of this bill, we've set out additional measures around adapting to the impacts of climate change, as well as provision for implementation of sector emission targets, as well as carbon budgets as limits to companies. There's also a requirement in terms of this bill that companies implement mitigation plans to show the type of investments that they would undertake over a period of time to achieve the budgets that have been set, as well as the sector targets. So the carbon tax is located within this broader context. There's also the processes of the Presidential Climate Commission in terms of the NDCs that was led last year, as well as the development of the Just Transition Framework and Implementation Plan, and work underway through the Just Energy Transition Partnership in terms of mobilizing finance for transitioning the electricity sector. We can move to the next slide. This just illustrates that from 2010 to now, we are in a very different situation. The climate risks are tangible, they are real, as we've seen with the recent floods in KZN. We've seen the impacts of the severe droughts in the Eastern Cape and the Western Cape, and the severe storms that we also experienced in the last few years. This is not, South Africa is not immune to the impact of climate change. This is also being experienced by other countries globally. So I think it's important to say that this is going to be one of the biggest risks that face South Africa going forward. Momo?
Yeah, no, Chair and Shalyn. Chair, just if I can just be excused for about 30 minutes, I have to go to the SCOA committee. And I will come back to this committee, but I do leave you in very capable hands here. Thank you.
Thanks, Momo. I'll proceed. Thanks, Mpho. So overall, the carbon tax is key to facilitating a just transition. With the global impacts of climate change, business as usual is no longer an option. And there is a concerted effort to shift towards a more climate resilient, lower carbon economy. The introduction of the carbon tax is aimed to internalize those negative externality costs of climate change and correct the market failure that already exists and to price these externalities into the various goods. In that way, it closes the price gap between low carbon and emission intensive products and influences behavior. It does provide a powerful incentive for us to do this because it's in the way it's implemented, it's an economy-wide tax that taps into opportunities to reduce emissions across the board. It doesn't set a fixed limit on the emissions, so it does provide some flexibility to companies to respond to the price signals and make the various investments. As mentioned, we started off at a very low rate and the aim is to phase this tax in to the correct level over time, which is part of the reason behind the proposals that have been put forward. The design of the tax is important and to ensure that we minimize potential adverse impacts on households and industry competitiveness, and the design includes revenue recycling measures and some allowances. However, going forward, there is an expectation that through our emissions commitments, we will have to take on tighter targets in terms of achieving the 1.5 degree temperature goal under the Paris Agreement. So the certainty on tax-free allowances will basically depend on the progress we make on reducing our emissions. The significant risks associated with border carbon adjustments that have been put forward by the European Union, the US is also following behind, and these could impose further additional costs on business, especially if the carbon footprint of their products are not reduced. The tax will force companies to evaluate their long-term investment decisions, and in doing that, it will prepare South African companies for the global transition that we need to make and strengthen their competitiveness. There's also an opportunity to leapfrog in terms of new technologies and investments that are required for this new economy. So the carbon tax is key to facilitating a just transition by giving effect to the polluter pays principle and internalizing those costs. And it complements the various pieces of work underway through the Commission as well as through the Department of Environment. And Paul, we can move to the next slide. So quickly, the proposals that were announced in budget aim to provide that space for an additional 3 years for companies to transition and recover from COVID and from the second phase onwards, from 2026 to 2030. A set of proposals was put forward around ramping up the headline carbon tax rate. And the intention was to provide policy certainty to companies on the carbon price over the short, medium, and longer term to guide their future investment decisions and to help achieve our net zero commitments by 2050. Next slide, Mpul. So this is just a summary of the proposals that were put forward for the rate increases. So for the period 2023 to 2025, there were proposals for increases of the tax rate by $1, $2, and $3 equivalent in 2025. And then for 2026 and 2030, it was proposed that the rates increase to a $20 equivalent and then $30 equivalent in 2030. And for the period 2027 to 2029, there is a linear increase in the rates. Linked to $2.5 US dollars per ton CO2 equivalent. The reason why the tax is presented or was presented in a US dollar equivalent is because firstly, this is a global environmental externality. So emissions anywhere in the world has the same impact. And it also takes into account the various technical analysis that has been done to assess the global costs of carbon there, and then secondly, to also take into account the possible imposition of carbon border adjustments, and there will be a requirement that the carbon tax rate applied locally will be converted into a dollar or a euro equivalent in order to align with the measures that they would be proposing. Next slide, Mpo. So overall, the comments on the carbon tax, there was broad support for the carbon tax and its role in terms of the transition. There were some stakeholders that did not support the carbon tax rates that were proposed for 2026 and 2030. The view is that this is too soon, it's too high, and it will impact on companies. They will not be able to invest in decarbonization and could result in a premature closure of companies. There was a view that the annual rate should be reduced and increased by inflation plus 2 percentage points up until 2030. And then from 2035 onwards, there could be consideration of higher carbon prices into account more analysis on mitigation and socioeconomic impacts. On the other hand, there were stakeholders that were of the view that the carbon, the implementation of an effective carbon price is a powerful tool to change behavior. It helps to alter the economic incentives and will be a crucial mechanism in helping to achieve our emissions commitments under the NDCs as well as the Paris Agreement. And then pricing carbon correctly to reflect the actual cost is key in terms of a low carbon transition. Next slide. It was broadly acknowledged that the risks of climate change are severe, they are growing. The incidences of extreme events around storms, flooding, droughts will have massive implications for the SA economy. There were some estimates of around the cost ranging from cost in the region of around 120 billion US dollars to the economy. There was an acknowledgement that there's a need for deep and urgent emission reductions, which is crucial. An implementation of a tax that is meaningful, limits double incentives, and is based on our NDC commitments was recommended. There was an acknowledgement of the rates proposed by the high-level panel on carbon pricing and the proposals around 50 to 100 US dollars, reaching an effective rate of around 75 US dollars in 2030. The proposals of the IMF around 50 US dollars by 2030, as well as the work that has been done by the National Business Initiative and its analysis, which recommended carbon pricing by 2030 in line with the high-level panel and the IMF. There was also an acknowledgement that these costs or these carbon prices do not reflect the full social costs of carbon, which is in the region of around 150 to 350 US dollars. There were recommendations that the proposed amendments beyond 2030 should be aligned with our GHG emission reductions commitments and commensurate with the best available climate science that is in place. And then lastly, in terms of the comments on the rates, there was a view that the rates proposed or the proposal for 2030 which was the rate would be determined by the Minister of Finance in the budget, that this is amended to ensure that there's a progressive increase in the carbon tax to reflect our mitigation commitments. And there was a proposal that this is increased, rate is increased post 2030 to be commensurate with the best available science related to the effective mitigation of emissions and in accordance with our NDC. We can move to the next slide. Next slide, please. So we considered all the comments from the various stakeholders and as well as the various carbon prices that have been put forward. As a bare minimum, if you're looking at the work that's been done by the National Business initiative. There's an estimate that the carbon price should actually be in the region of around 425 rands per ton CO2 in 2025, increasing to around 2,975 rand per ton CO2 in 2050. And this is the level of taxation that's required to drive that behavior change. And it was also acknowledged that the current rate is very low in the region of around $2 per ton CO2. It also took into account and considered an average of the carbon prices from the various analysis that has been done. And this showed that the carbon prices for the period 2025 to 2050 should be in the region of 46 to 256 US dollars per ton. Next slide. This slide just shows what are some of the international developments around carbon pricing. The scope of carbon pricing, both carbon taxes and emissions trading, has been growing over the last couple of years. There are currently around 36 carbon tax policy instruments implemented and 32 emissions trading schemes measures. There are measures around carbon taxation that's applied across the various continents. We take note of the developments in Mexico. China has implemented an emissions trading scheme. India has had in place a coal tax, as well as the various developments in Indonesia, Chile, Singapore around carbon taxation. There is a shift towards countries setting out the future carbon price path in order to drive that behavior change at a local level and to enhance their competitiveness. As carbon pricing expands, the potential adverse impacts on industry competitiveness will recede, and it's important that we align with the rates that have been implemented already. Next slide. So broadly, in terms of the comments that have been submitted, the comment regarding the proposed rate increase by inflation plus 2 percentage points until 2030, with higher prices only considered after 2035, is not accepted. The reasons for this is quite broad. Firstly, South Africa has made those comments under the Paris Agreement to reduce our emissions. Our emissions have to peak in 2025 and decline from there onwards. A credible carbon price will be crucial as part of the policy framework, which was outlined earlier, and it will go a long way in terms of building up a cost-effective climate policy framework. It also provides that flexibility to industry around investments that need to be made versus paying the carbon tax. The rates proposed aim to provide the policy certainty. The proposed rate increase of inflation plus 2 percentage points until 2030, with the higher prices implemented after 2035, does not sufficiently reflect the polluter pays principle and our approach around the just transition, and does not reflect the growing climate risks that we are facing as a country. It is also not in line with the various carbon price proposals through the various under the Paris Agreement and required to meet the 2 degree temperature goal. So for the headline rate currently proposed in the draft PLAB, the effective carbon tax rate, if we assume an average tax-free allowance of 80 to 85%, will be around 46 to 62 rand a ton carbon dioxide equivalent in 2026, and 69 to 99 rand per ton CO2 equivalent in 2030. This rate is also much lower if we take into account the deductions that are available for the carbon tax under the Income Tax Act, where it's tax deductible, and some of the other deductions that are provided within the Carbon Tax Act. Although the proposed rates for 2022 under the PLAB are below the carbon prices required to fully internalize the externality costs of climate change, they would start to align with the average effective rates implemented globally, which we've seen earlier, and average around 5 to 6 US dollars. It would also not impose a significant tax burden on companies, but it would send an important signal to drive future investment decisions and encourage companies to invest in lower carbon technologies in order to lower their tax liability. And then we acknowledge the global shift towards low carbon production, which is now unavoidable, especially with the threat of carbon border adjustments and the EU ETS carbon price of around 100 euros is probably the reference point. The sooner local companies can begin to transition, the more competitive they will be and avoid the imposition of these taxes. Next slide. We can take note of the comments around the post-2030 increases to the carbon tax rate. This comment is accepted to basically increase the carbon tax rate post-2030, commensurate with the best available science related to effective GHG emission reduction and in accordance with our nationally determined contribution commitments. It's important to note that for every ton of greenhouse gas emitted, there are far-reaching consequences, and we need to account for those externality costs in the pricing. So effecting the polluter pays principle beyond 2030 will be especially more important because the carbon space is going to be more limited. The global developments are also quite clear that countries need to transition, especially around the electricity sector. It also takes into account that if we don't act urgently, this will impact future generations significantly and would not be in line with the principle of intergenerational equity. Next slide. We can move on. Next slide. So broadly, in terms of beyond the comments on the tax rates, there were comments on the tax-free allowances and the incentives. This is based on the announcements that were made in Budget 2022 around an approach to consider changes to the allowances that are currently applicable, and there were some assumptions made around this. So broadly, stakeholders requested guidance on the phasing out of allowances that this was not included in the 2020 in the TLAB for the period from 2026. There was a view that this created policy uncertainty, and it was then interpreted that either the allowances would be totally removed or significantly reduced by 2030. So clarity was requested on this. There was also a view that the allowances have been key to assist a business in transitioning. There was a proposal that the allowances under the carbon tax are expanded and retained, and where phase out is planned, that this is clearly articulated. There was a view that where carbon pricing is implemented internationally, that there are various compensation measures that are introduced, such as free allocations, subsidies, there's ring fencing of revenues, as well as targeted funding is provided for research, development, and innovation, and supporting policies are needed. On the other hand, there were some views that the allowances undermine the carbon tax, and allowances such as the basic trade exposure and carbon budget allowances should be removed. There were also comments around the need to consider carbon border adjustments for hard-to-abate sectors. And lastly, there were comments the allowances should start to be phased out because of the time that has been provided to industry to prepare for the transition, for the carbon tax and the higher rates that would be implemented, and also acknowledging the very low effective tax rate. Next slide, Mpo. So in response, we take note of the comments regarding the announcements that were made in Budget 2022 on the tax-free allowances. It should be noted that there were the announcements outlined an approach on the allowances going forward, and the aim is to strengthen the incentives under the carbon tax. So there were broad announcements around the basic tax-free allowance to be reduced over time, and at the same time to consider increases in allowances like the carbon offset. It was also announced that these and other proposals will form part of the review for the second phase to inform future budget announcements. So there was not a specific announcement in the minister's budget speech, nor in the budget review, that all tax-free allowances will be phased out or removed by 2030. And this seemed to be the main assumption made in terms of the various assessments that have been done across the different sectors of the impact of the carbon tax on business. So in light of the extension of the first phase and to provide policy certainty, a paper will be published in 2023 on possible design options for the tax-free allowances under the carbon tax for public comment and further stakeholder consultation. This will take into account the comments that we've received now on the 2022 draft TLAB, as well as our commitments in terms of our NDCs and the net zero commitments to 2050. So this will form part of an extensive consultation process. We also take note of the comments on the various on the request for incentives and subsidies, retention of some of the allowances, and the carbon tax is actually there to close that price gap between low and high carbon emitting technologies and energy efficiency measures, and to encourage the shift. The current design provides the various allowances to assist with the transition. And the specific reference to the EU ETS and some of the support that's provided through the what's called indirect compensation. And in terms of the current carbon tax, we do provide for indirect electricity costs that may impact industries by providing this electricity price neutrality commitment, as well as dedicated allowance for trade exposure and process emissions. So future adjustments to the tax-free allowance will again take into account the impact on hard-to-abate sectors, the availability of mitigation technologies, and the pace and scale of the transition over the next decade. This will also consider the work underway by the Department of Forestry, Fisheries, and the Environment on the sector emission targets and carbon budget. We have in place incentives already for research and development, renewable energy, and biodiversity conservation and management as well. There was a comment around the Act should actually provide for a retention of the allowances. Currently, there is no sunset clause on the allowances that have been put in place, so this comment is not accepted. We can move to the next slide. Next slide. There were broad comments around the need for detailed bottom-up analysis and socio-economic impact assessment of the tax, and the need for socio-economic modeling going forward. There was a view that detailed analysis on the impact of the tax, taking into account the mitigation potential and the fuel switching prices, as well as the time for various sectors to transition, was proposed, and there were specific proposals that further work will be done by industry to study the implications of the tax going forward. We can move to the next slide. So these comments are noted. However, we would like to state that in preparation for the implementation of the carbon tax in 2019, there were various carbon tax modeling studies undertaken by the National Treasury, the Economic Policy Section, by various local academics at the University of Pretoria, at the Energy Research Centre, as well as institutions such as the World Bank. The broad findings from these studies, and it was CGE modeling that was done, shows that the carbon tax will make a significant contribution to reducing emissions, and the economic impact of the tax can be reduced and will depend on the revenues, on how the revenues are used. there. So the broad design of the carbon tax currently provides the transition mechanism in terms of the allowances as well as the recycling of the revenue through electricity price neutrality, as well as tax incentives that are that have been implemented for energy efficiency. This study and various other studies was debated at a workshop that we had in 2016, and this provides us with a reasonable understanding of the broader environment and economic impacts of the tax. So this just presents some of that. Next slide. We take note of the proposal to do further mitigation potential analysis work, and as well as proposed by the industry. But we also bring to your attention two pieces of work that has been undertaken over the last possibly around 2 or 3 years and is still underway. So the first piece of work is the work that has been initiated by the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment on the developing a mitigation potential analysis to help inform our NDCs as well as the sector targets and the carbon budgets. And this will also assist industry with developing their mitigation plans required under the climate change bill. So this study was initially undertaken in 2014, and then it was updated in the last 2 years. There were various updates to the document, but overall it shows that there is potential for reducing the emissions intensity related to electricity across the different sectors in the economy up to 2050. And it also indicated that there's potential to reduce process emissions over a longer time period as well. The second piece of work is work that was initiated through the National Business Initiative, and various institutions were part of this work to basically assist sectors identify mitigation potential and look at decarbonization pathways. It also considered the fuel switching prices for cement, iron and steel, and the electricity sectors, and it showed that carbon pricing has to be increased in order to also drive those changes. So overall, we would recommend that building on the work of the NBI as well as the DSSE on the mitigation potential analysis, a further work can be undertaken by industry in terms of the mitigation potential and identifying the opportunities that the transition presents as well. And we would be happy to engage on that going forward there. I'll go through the rest of the slides quite quickly. There were broad comments around the US dollar-based carbon tax rates. Stakeholders were concerned that the current US dollar denominated rates provides uncertainty and instability regarding the impact on taxpayers because of the fluctuations in the rand dollar exchange rate. There was a suggestion that this is converted back into a rand based rate. We can go to the next slide. This proposal has been accepted. The rates would be converted to rand equivalent using the average exchange rates published by the South African Reserve Bank. The latest data that is available for a 12-month period is the data for August 2021 to end of July 2022. So we propose that the average exchange rate of 15 rand 40 to the dollar is used to convert the carbon tax rates. And the rates are outlined in the next slide. We also take note that there will be global carbon pricing developments going forward and to ensure equivalence with border carbon taxes that could be applied against exported products, that future periodic adjustments of the carbon tax rates that have been proposed may be required, for example, every 3 years. Next slide. So this just outlines the rand equivalent of the US dollar proposed rates that have been put forward. So that translates into 308 rand for 2026 and 462 rand per ton CO2 equivalents in 2030. Next slide. So there were broad comments around the alignment of the carbon budget a policy of the Department of Environment and the carbon tax. There were views that the carbon tax can be implemented while the work on the carbon budgets as well as the sector targets continue, and there's no need to delay the implementation of the carbon tax amendments. There were concerns raised related to the climate change bill, which initially provided for a penalty for emissions above the carbon budget to be implemented as under the carbon tax, but this was removed in the version that has been processed through Parliament currently. So further clarity on this penalty mechanism for non-compliance with the carbon budget has been requested for the higher rates for emissions exceeding the budget. There was also clarity requested on how this higher tax rate for emissions above the budget would be applied, and whether it would be applied on a five-yearly basis or annually. There was a view that if it is applied on an annual basis, then it could unfairly penalize a company if it's within its budget over a five-year period. And then lastly, there was a comment around if there's a delay in the implementation of the climate bill and the mandatory carbon budget system of the DFSE, then there should be an extension of the carbon budget allowance. Next slide. So we accept the comment regarding provision of certainty on the carbon budget, carbon tax alignment, and the higher carbon tax rate to come into effect for emissions above the budget from 2023. The Carbon Tax Act will be amended once the Climate Change Bill is enacted to provide for this. It will also be aligned with the gazetting of the carbon budget regulations. This was also announced in Budget 2022. On the comment regarding the accounting period for the application of this higher tax rate, we take note of the comment regarding the implementation of an annualized penalty mechanism. However, we feel it's important to align the accounting period under the carbon budgets with the current carbon tax period to avoid a situation where companies face a significant tax liability at the end of the five-year period, and then finalization of this design would be done after consultations with stakeholders. And lastly on this, we take note of the filing of the carbon tax, of the comments around extending the carbon budget allowance beyond 2022. However, we are of the view that this may not be necessary, because the filing of carbon tax returns and payments of the tax for the 2023 period will only happen in around July 2024. So we do expect that the climate change bill will be enacted before that period, and that would be taken into account as well. We can move to the next slide. I'll just ask my colleague Kushle to come in quickly and touch on the remaining issues under the carbon tax.
Okay. Thank you, Shailen. Good morning to the chair, to the honourable members, and as well as the stakeholders that are on the call. So in terms of the electricity price neutrality extension, this was proposed in budget of 2022 with the extension of the first phase of the carbon tax, as well as the extension of the electricity price neutrality, which would be extended until December 2025. Next slide, please. Now, the comments around the extension of the commitment to price neutrality were largely welcomed by stakeholders. There was a view from business that this concession should remain in perpetuity or until industry is decarbonized. There were further suggestions that there should be further work that is done to understand the impact of the removal of the electricity price neutrality on industry. There is further concern that there may be double benefits that are provided to large emitters through the double deduction of their tax liability on the renewable energy investments under the carbon tax, as well as the fact that the carbon tax in itself provides a primary incentive to shift to lower carbon electricity. There's also a view that in order to give effect to the polluter pays principle, that electricity generators should pay the full price of the carbon tax liability. There is also a view that government should commit to increasing renewable energy in the electricity grid, as well as a commitment to reduce the overall carbon intensity in the electricity mix. Now, those comments are noted, and in light of the extension of the electricity price neutrality by 3 years, further work will be done in order to assess the impact of removing the concession on different sectors, and there may be further consideration that is given to extending the deduction to an additional 3 to 5 years and refining future design of the incentive to remove any double benefits. Next slide, please. There were further comments that related to state-owned entities that claim the renewable energy premium deduction through power purchase agreements that are concluded under the REIPPP program. Now, due to the restructuring of the electricity sector, which includes separation of the generation, transmission, and distribution functions, it is envisioned that the PPAs that are concluded under the REIPPP program will be transferred to the National Transmission Company of South Africa when it commences its operations. However, the tax liability that arises from the greenhouse gas emissions under the 1A1 category will remain within the function of the generation entity. So there were proposals by stakeholders that the TLAB should include a provisional transitional provision that allows electricity generators to continue to claim the renewable energy premium deduction in respect of the PPAs that are ceded to the NTCSA. There were further proposals from stakeholders to include the 1A4 activities under the price neutrality commitment. The response is that these proposals are accepted. The 2022 draft TLAB will be amended to include a transitional provision to cater for the restructuring of the state-owned entity, and that further changes to the TLAB will be made in order to include the 1A4 category to align the tax treatment of similar activities. Next slide, please. With regard to the 12L incentive, this was also extended in light of the extension of the first phase of the carbon tax till 2025, December of 2025. Next slide, please. So the comments around this is that there's general support for the extension of the 12L incentive, and that some stakeholders are of the view that the rate should be increased to at least R1.55 per kilowatt hour in order to align with the increasing electricity prices. It is also proposed that the 12-hour extension be aligned with the increase of the carbon tax rate. There were further some concerns that were raised by stakeholders on improving access of the incentives and streamlining the process for small and medium-sized firms. The proposals are noted. The energy efficiency improvements and investments, however, are a low-hanging fruit that business should be undertaking in any case. And with the increase of the carbon tax rate and the electricity price increases, a case to justify the extension of the 12-hour incentive beyond 2025 is not a strong case, and it's difficult to justify. However, there is recognition that work can be done to include more SMMEs in accessing the incentive, and work is being done with SANEDI to streamline and simplify the process for SMMEs to access the tax incentive. Thank you. I'll hand over back to Charlene.
Thanks, Kushle, for that. So this section just deals quickly with the comments related to carbon sequestration, a deduction provided under the Carbon Tax Act. We can move to the next slide. So in the 2022 budget, we announced that there will be a limitation on this deduction to activities within the operational control of
the taxpayers, and this was related to concerns around potential abuse of this particular provision and double claims, especially when it came to third-party timber production. We can move to the next slide. So broadly, there was support for this proposal around the limitation, with some concerns raised on the definition of operational control and whether there was alignment between the definition in the Carbon Tax Act and the definition used by the Department of Environment in terms of the greenhouse gas emission reporting regulations, and if the boundaries were similar. And industry was of the view that applying the definition of operational control, which applies for purposes of the greenhouse gas reporting regulations, would assist them as well in accepting third party in allowing third party timber production to form part of this deduction. The industry has implemented a pilot project with its various members to develop a methodology to register, report, and verify these emissions, sequestered emissions, to assist with potential, preventing potential abuse of this. We can move to the next slide. Broadly, the view is that the concept of operational control is common in the Customs and Excise Act. So for example, currently the registration and licensing requirements for customs and excise purposes are applied to those persons who are in charge of the operations that are regulated by that act. Similarly, the rules in the act define the emissions facilities which a taxpayer must license for carbon tax purposes as those premises where a taxable activity occurs over which the taxpayer has operational control. So for purposes of the act, we have the view that there is no need to define operational control as it has been the meaning attributed in terms of the normal everyday use of operational control. And then secondly, we welcome and take note of the project implemented by industry to develop a proper monitoring and reporting and verification protocol for third-party timber growers, and that would help immensely with preventing abuse and double claims of this deduction. Next slide. Next slide. There were requests in the comments around extending the sequestration deduction to include saw milling activities as well, as they are quite similar in terms of the production and the value chain around this, and they are also guidance is provided through the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and Environment methodology for greenhouse gas emission sequestration, which also includes sequestration related to sawmilling activities. We can move to the next slide. So this comment was accepted given the similarity between the sawmilling activities and the paper and pulp activities, and to ensure alignment of the tax treatment of similar activities. And then the last comment was there were some requests around extending this deduction to include other sectors as part of the stakeholder consultations with industry and other stakeholder groups. This was considered, and the outcome of that discussion is that this would be considered on a case-by-case basis. Further work will be undertaken by industry to develop the case for the extension of the deduction, as well as to develop appropriate methodologies to estimate the emissions sequestered. And this should also take into account the current regulatory requirements facing the different sectors, as well as the monitoring and verification system that would be required in terms to limit potential tax avoidance. Overall, it would be important to maintain the environment integrity of the carbon tax, So these savings should be considered in terms of the principles of contributing to additional emission savings, as well as to ensure that they are permanent and available over time. It's also, we would note that taxpayers can also access the carbon offset allowance. So thanks, Chair, and thanks, Yanga. That finishes the carbon tax issues.
Thanks, Chair, honorable members. I don't know, we want to ask guidance from the Chair, because both carbon tax and vaping, we received a lot of comments, and even during public consultation, they took time. So we want to ask the Chair, how must we proceed? Must we do all the remaining slides, each and every issue, or we only proceed on important items, Chair?
I think the latter the better, because you can distribute the document even to the participants who are the stakeholders. As you can see, it's already, what time is it now? It's half past 10, and we have updated you an hour. So you have already gone beyond an hour.
Thank you, Chair. The other bigger item of which it was presented to the public hearings, also in Parliament, of which you want to deal with, is the impact of IFRS 17 insurance contracts on the taxation of insurers. Because others, I think all the issues we tried to respond to during public workshops, but this is the issue that Honorable Abraham asked Lizelle Kutsair, because the issue whereby they were asking for a 10-year phasing-in period. I will hand over to Ndlandla Khadebe, the director and the specialist in this, to deal with it. I think it is on slide, if we can go to slide 97. Thank you. Ndlandla, over to you.
And good morning, honorable members. Basically, the IFRS 17 on its own, what was happening is that it was the restatement of insurance liabilities. So what's happening is that if you look into, okay, I'm going to talk, well, it's exactly the same, but let me mention an example of long-term insurer and say, here you have assets and then you have liabilities. So if to the extent that the liabilities are less and you have more assets, then the tax liability will be created in that instance. So the issue then, what we did, the same with the long-term, with the short-term insurer, we then gave a phasing-in period of 3 years for the short-term and we gave 6 years for the long-term insurer. Basically, the first comment that we received, and that is on slide 99. The first one was, it's more about the terminology. So with the short-term insurer, the issue that happened was that we have to update the terminology so that it is in line with the IFRS 17. So the first one basically was to say that now that currently the short-term insurers, they disclose the premium as gross written receipt. So now the issue is all those concepts are going. So now the concept that should be used will be the insurance revenue. And that comment has been accepted. We can go to the next slide. The next one, basically, the issue relates to certain sale arrangements, because now they were not catered for. So what we're doing now going forward is to ensure that the premiums that is received by third party self captives is also taxed under Section 28. Then the next comment that we received was to say that we have to refer to the concept that is being used in IFRS 17 in relation to the liabilities for incurred claims. So we accepted this comment because mostly, as I stated earlier, we want to align the taxation of a short-term insurer with IFRS. Next slide. Then the next one was on, basically this one is exactly the same, the two issues here. It's more about the disclosure requirement now going forward. So if RIS 17 now requires that any unearned premium reserve should be set off against liability. So in the event that you have, let's say, short-term insurer that has a year end of June, and then I take a policy with them in May. So what's going to happen is that the short-term insurer is going to disclose, let's say, 120, going to disclose the first amount for May and June. The rest of the other amount, if I took a policy of, let's say, 120, the other 100 will come in as unearned premium reserve. So, but now the issue now is that going forward, that unearned premium reserve must be set off. And the saying the disclosure requirement shouldn't create a tax liability. So we accepted that comment, and basically it's the first comment and the comment in relation to section 28.4, which was the next one. Next slide, please. Okay, this one now is in relation to salvages. Any amount that a short-term insurer gets reimbursed by a reinsurer, or amount that are received from unrelated third parties, currently we tax them on receipt. So the issue now is that if the 17 requires or when says they should be accrual, so what we're going to do is now we have to amend the current taxation so that it's actually aligned as well with IFRS 17. So the comment was accepted. And one of the issues is that these changes, some of these changes, they affect the phasing in amount. So all of those subsequent changes will be made in the phasing in amount. And then the next comment we received was in relation to the branches of a foreign reinsurer, where now they are saying that they are a branch and they are reporting in US accounting standard and they cannot use the IFRS 17. So we said no, this comment is not accepted. We cannot have two different accounting standards. So that was the comment in relation to the short-term insurer. Okay, the comments with relation to a long-term insurer. The first one basically was the phasing in period, because now that tax liability we have to phase in over 6 years so that companies are not going to have issues with liquidity. So we received comments in relation to say possibly we have to extend the 6 year period and make it to 10 years. And then we're saying we noted this because at the moment, most of these insurers, they haven't even submitted their tax returns, so probably they're going to do it next year. And we say we will then engage industry in the event that we see any liquidity issues emanating from IFRS 17 going forward. So we noted the comment. Then the next comment we received basically was the mechanism at which we allowed the phasing in period. So what the industry are requesting is that they want us to go back to the adjusted IFRS basis, which was the method we used when we were moving from a statutory basis to IFRS basis in 2015. So we have accepted that because the current proposal in the current TLEP basically was not favored by most of the members of ASISA, and only one member per se was in favor of the current method. So next slide, please. Then the issue was that the current proposal did not cater for any capital gains issues, and there might be some liquidity implications when now an insurer is moving certain assets are being transferred to match the liabilities. So we said, no, we accepted that comment. We will address it going forward by using the reference to the value of liability. And then the next comment as well is in relation to how we're phasing in this amount over 6 years. And what we're using is that we're using adjusted IFRS, but then the problem with that is that there are certain liabilities now going forward that is not going to fall in within the definition, or actually falling in the definition of value of liabilities. So the adjusted IFRS base on its own is not enough. So we then said we accepted the comment. So going forward, we're going to use the value of liabilities definition. Okay, next slide, please. The issue, this one per se is similar to the ones in short-term insurer, where you have now your premium debtors, which were disclosed separate. Now those debtors are now used in the calculation of liabilities. So what we are then saying that is that we are saying that comment is accepted. And then the phasing in amount will exclude the premium debtors. And I think the same thinking is exactly the same, to say the change in disclosure should not create a tax liability. So that is an if. And then on the next one, the issues was that now in certain instances, there might be a case where the market value of the asset is actually less than the value of liability. So there were some complications there. So they're saying that that deficit that has been created on transition to IFRS 17, we should actually do something about it now going forward. And then we're saying this comment has been accepted. It was one of the shortcomings within the current draft legislation. So we'll address that part. The next comment basically is on clarification. To cater for instances where a reinsurer, because there is much more of insurance-related investment that we accounted using another standard. And now to say going forward, we need to clarify that investment contract liabilities are also catered for under this IFRS 17 going forward. So we're saying we accepted that and changes will be made on this. Thank you so much, members. Yana?
Thank you, Nhlanhla. I think, Chair, to be fair, we can move now to tax administration because the time is 10:40, so that France can lead the presentation on some of the tax administration issues, because we can't live here without being turned up. Thank you. Over to you, France.
So, thank you, Yanga. And good morning to the Honourable Chair and Honourable Members and other stakeholders. I'll be very, very brief here. So if we could just move on to the next slide. So there are two sets of key issues under the Customs and Excise amendments. The one was around the definition of an invoice. We got some comments here, and you'll see here that what we're suggesting is that we'll look at those just to make sure that we're picking up the issues that have been raised by commentators. But in other areas, we do point out that the existing interpretation applies, and so we don't think that specific definitions are required. Moving on. But the other key issue was the introduction of advanced rulings in the customs and excise space. Now, here we picked up a number of comments that seem to confuse advanced rulings in the tax space with advanced rulings in the customs space. Although we use similar terminology, the two sets of rulings are trying to achieve quite different things. So, for example, you will see that one of the commentators says, well, we should rule on interpretation just as we do in the tax system. But the key point is, in the tax system, we don't rule on valuation, which is a key point that we do rule on in the customs and excise system. So what we're conveying in our response here, and that's on the next slide. Move on again, please. Right, and move on once more. Thank you. So what we're driving at here is they are two different separate sets of rulings that are being issued here, and the rulings in the customs and excise space are informed by our international obligations and should be interpreted in that light. That's not to say that at some date in the future we can't move on to interpretive issues, but that's not a short-term objective, It's probably not even a medium-term objective because the emphasis has to be on meeting our international commitments. Moving on. Let's continue through to the Tax Administration Act issues, please. Right. So we have two major sets of issues here. The one is around the imposition of an understatement penalty for the Employment Tax Incentive, or ETI. The first set of comments indicated that we may be going retrospective because we gave a simple effective date. The proposal is that we should, in fact, push this out until March of 2023 and make it only applicable to returns received after that date. The difficulty with that, of course, is that then permits mischief to be continued to be perpetrated without fear of any kind of understatement penalty for the next 6 months. And people can adjust outstanding returns again on that basis. So while we accept the point that's being made, our solution is somewhat different, and we're saying that what we should probably do is apply to returns that are filed on or after the 1st of September of 2022. And so we get away from the idea that we're going to be touching on returns in the past. Then there's the potential for some duplication between a penalty in the ETI Act and the understatement penalty. We accept that, and we will provide for a mechanism so that there isn't a doubling up of penalties. Moving on. We get to the tax compliance status issue. Two sets of issues here then really that come through from the comments in summary. The one is people are somewhat uncomfortable with the idea that SARS is acting on a suspicion, and they're suggesting that we should either complete an audit to take care of the issue, or that we should be held to the same kind of burden of proof that would be required to complete an audit. The difficulty with those submissions is, of course, that rightfully an audit process is one that takes some time and has a number of procedural steps. So by the time you've done all of that, you're in a situation where whatever the mischief was by putting in null returns or trying to game the system has already been achieved because you're some months down the track. That is our lived experience at the moment because, of course, we could do audits and we could raise assessments to do away with the null returns that have been put in, for example. But again, that takes time, and what we need is a mechanism to move more quickly where we come into these fairly serious issues. So moving on. And again, the other issue that seems to be coming through is that taxpayers think that what we're doing is we will be revoking access if we see that there's a question of a fraud, misrepresentation, or non-disclosure of material facts, and that we will revoke and then give taxpayers 10 days to come back to us, and then we will consider it, and then we will take a decision to reinstate. It in fact works the other way around. We give taxpayers 10 days notice that we in fact have these concerns and give them an opportunity to come back to us. And it is only if the taxpayer is unable to satisfy that our concerns have no merit that the access would be revoked. And then finally, the point was made here that people are concerned that this isn't something that should be done lightly, and that senior SARS officials should be doing this. And that's a point well made, and we would propose changing to reserve that power to a senior SARS official. I think those are the highlights, and I will hand back to Yanka.
Thank you, Chair. We've come to the end of our presentation. We welcome any questions or comments in this regard. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to item 3. What's item 3? Alan, item 3 is the stakeholders making comments.
Yes, Chair. It is 3 minutes each per stakeholder, and the first one, I'm just opening this, is
Video Association.
That's right, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Video Association, are you there?
Thank you, Chair. Can you hear me?
Timing. You have been here several times. You know how to time yourself, please.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the opportunity. I think today, to fully utilize our time, I'll ask my colleague, Gregory, who is also on the call today. Greg, you can take over in terms of our comments. Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you, Patricia. Good morning, Chair, honorable members, stakeholders. Given our relative short time to make presentation, I'll be brief in talking through the three aspects we would like to raise. In response to the responses received, it would be the excise duty increases and the impact on consumers, maintaining an excise policy over the next 3 years, and our advocacy for a simplified excise duty rate structure. As previously presented, Chair and members, in 2021, there are unintended consequences with an above inflation rate excise duty increase, which undoubtedly impact on the consumer. In reality, consumers are price sensitive, and the SA consumer is unlikely to be deterred from consumption by raising prices, but rather consumers seek a, in inverted commas, tax-free alternatives in the illicit market. The illicit market presents significant risks to both the consumers and the fiscus, and consumers then have a tendency, as evidenced by independent research, to gravitate towards these illicit or low-cost alcohol products. And these low alcohol products represent a significant risk both to the legitimate market, the fiscus, and the consumer. The second point that we would like to address in our brief response is the maintenance of excise tax policy over the next 3 years. Historically, the excise duty increases has surpassed the inflation rate, and in certain years have nearly doubled that of the inflation rate. This has had a cumulative impact over the last 6 years alone of around 17%. And so BASA wishes to, in fact, put forward the position and advocate that we have excise policy certainty related to the inflation rate over the next 3 years, which will encourage investor sentiment and confidence in the industry. The next point that we'd like to just briefly address is the different excise duty rates. And we'd like to highlight that BASA does not, in fact, have the contention relating to the harmonized tariff that should be reviewed. And indeed, BASA recognizes that SA is part of the World Customs Organization and that there is a definite need for product classification. What we, however, do contend is that the rates applied should be simplified and based on alcohol by volume. The current varying excise rate structure applied is indeed an inhibitor to product innovation and are based on the historic system, which again presents a clear particular bias. A simplified excise tax rate methodology is indeed in support of Treasury's position on simplification. This proposal, in addition, will encourage product innovation towards lower ABV products, which again is in support of the World Health Organization's move, while not being overly punitive towards other products falling within the same alcohol by volume range.
Gregory, are you summarizing? As you know,
yes, I am. Yes, I am, Chair.
There are many colleagues of yours.
Yes, I am, Chair. So, Chair, in conclusion, those are the three elements that BASA wishes to address: is one, the excise duty increases and the impact on consumers, the maintenance of the policy over the next 3 years, and a simplified excise duty rate structure. I thank you, Chair and members.
Thank you, Beer Association, for your presentation. The next stakeholder, BAT South Africa.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. My comments are in relation to the proposed vaping excise. First, Firstly, I'd like to thank National Treasury for noting our comments. However, there are two pertinent points that I'd like to raise. Firstly, on the 1 June 2023 implementation date, we respectfully submit that this date is too ambitious. This is a highly fragmented market with more unknowns than knowns, and SARS will need to fully understand this market, including the workings of the large do-it-yourself mixing market, before agreeing to a specific timing. Once the market is understood, then SARS will still need to consult on multiple issues with industry actors, such as bond requirements, payment terms, reporting requirements, tooling requirements, etc. Companies will also need to update their ERP systems and put governance and reporting processes and procedures in place. We need to bear in mind that this is the first time that the vast majority of industry actors have ever had to deal with an excisable product. Therefore, a more appropriate date would be 1 Jan 2024, in our view. Secondly, on the proposed excise rate, the comparable analysis presented by National Treasury does not, with respect, take into account purchasing power parity, product prices in South Africa, and other factors. In fact, when considering appropriate market adjustments, the proposed South African excise rate of 2.90 per mil will be one of the highest in the world. The excise will also cause certain products in the market to double. One needs to be cognizant of the fact that comparing an introductory rate to rates in established excise regimes may lead to a situation in South Africa where there's immediate non-compliance and fiscal evasion. If one looks at examples from Europe on how the legal market was decimated when high introductory rates were implemented, it is clear that South Africa should err on the side of caution on the introductory rate. Based on multiple analysis performed by us as well as Oxford Economics, we are strongly of the view that this introductory rate should be around 70 cents per milliliter. This rate will allow SARS to broaden its tax net and test the administrative system. Once all the actors in the market are brought into the tax net, then the rate can be appropriately increased. I thank you again, Chair, for the opportunity to present.
Thanks, Dean, from VATSA, Vapor Products Association.
Yes, I'm here. Good morning, Chair, committee members and stakeholders. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to make final comments on this issue. Chair, it is regrettable in our view that Treasury has opted to stick to its proposed position. As we have stated clearly, we do not think that the tax is warranted at this stage. In particular, we take issue with Treasury's one-sided review of science on the harms of vaping. We reiterate our view that vaping products are a harm-reduced alternative to smoking. Every piece of credible evidence bears this out. We must also point out that the US FDA that Treasury cites indeed approved a vaping product as a harm-reduced alternative to smoking. Chair, on the issue of youth, the issue of youth vaping is a problem to be tackled by all stakeholders. We as the vaping industry are doing our part. Unfortunately, tax is a blunt instrument in doing this. Youth will continue vaping through black market channels, and those products will be detrimental to their health. Tax will not solve this problem. We need a more comprehensive and stakeholder-inclusive approach in dealing with the issue of youth vaping, as we have with alcohol, etc. Unfortunately, smokers who are the legitimate targets of the industry will find the product unaffordable and are unlikely to make the switch, nor to continue using vaping products in the place of tobacco due to the exorbitant price increases that are likely to result from the imposition of this tax. Chair, we are struggling to understand the rationale for imposing a tax on non-nicotine products. It seems clear to us that these products fall outside the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control and stand to be treated differently to those containing nicotine. Why we are taxing non-nicotine products does not make sense. We urge Parliament to give serious consideration to this very important difference that is made in the FCTC. Lastly, Chair, this tax will put many vaping businesses out of business, coming as it does after the ban on the sale of the products in 2020. There is clear evidence that many vaping businesses will close their doors should this tax be imposed in its current form. I thank you, Chair, for the opportunity.
Thanks, Asanda, for your input. Next is Associations for Savings and Investments South Africa, ASISA.
Good morning, Chair and members of the Standing Committee on Finance. On behalf of ASISA, we thank you for the opportunity to provide feedback. ASISA members are appreciative of the recognition of the submissions made and that most items will be addressed. We look forward to the proposed engagement with National Treasury and SARS to review the changes to Section 29A because they are material and complex. Notwithstanding numerous submissions by ASISA and individual insurers, National Treasury has retained the 6-year phasing-in period. In the absence of the exact quantum of the transitional impact, we are of the view that a longer phasing-in period is in the interest of both the fiscus and the industry for the following reasons. The same phasing-in period of 6 years should not be the basis for determining the period. The same transition impacted only a small number of insurers, whereas IFRS 17 will impact virtually all insurers. Based on the outcome of the 2021 PwC Transitional Impact Study, the quantum of the IFRS 17 impact is also 3 times more compared to the same transition. The IFRS 17 transition can lead to severe liquidity and solvency strain if phased in over a short period. This may especially impact smaller insurers who were not able to make individual submissions to National Treasury earlier in this year because their numbers were not ready. Alignment of the phasing-in period with the average contract length on transition will ensure that insurers have the cash flow to pay the tax because cash flows arise over the lifetime of insurance policies, which can span in excess of 20 years on transition. There is also international precedent for this approach. A longer phasing-in period will not only protect the industry of any unintended cash flow consequences, but also protect the fiscus from uneven tax contributions from the industry. A 10-year phasing-in period was determined as the appropriate phasing-in period by the Actuarial Society of South Africa based on the numbers available from the 2021 PwC Transitional Impact Study. It was also the independent recommendation. If we compare the phasing-in period provided for the short-term insurers of 3 years to the 6 years provided for the long-term insurers, it is not equitable. A small number of short-term insurers will be impacted on transition to IFRS 17, where almost all long-term insurers will be impacted. The quantum of the IFRS 17 transition for long-term insurers is also substantially more material if compared to short-term insurers. The time frame in which the transitional impact will reverse for short-term insurers is much shorter if compared to long-term insurers, where the transitional impact will only reverse over a longer period based on the average contract length on transition, which will be in excess of 10 years. Then just a comment on the contributed tax capital. We note the first response to the contributed tax capital submissions. We assume that this response also makes reference to dividends paid to all shareholders proportionately. I thank you.
Thanks, Lizelle, ASISA. Saika, Sharon,
thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. Thank you for National Treasury for their detailed response and SARS as well. We'd like to thank them for a lot of the comments that we made that they have accepted, and we do really appreciate that. I'm going to be very quick and just touch on a few. For instance, I'm going to start off with the carbon tax. And what we were looking for there was basically certainty and clarity on a lot of issues, and we do appreciate the clarity provided on the US dollar rates and the proposed change to bring that back into rand. Which will help a lot and prevent any volatility in calculating those particular rates. I won't go on to detail. I won't discuss at all the rate trajectory. I'll leave that up to those that have more detailed information on that. But we do thank them for the input into how they actually got to these rates and comparisons to other countries, which helps us understand to a certain extent the methodology that informed the rates that they are proposing. Regarding the tax-free allowances, we welcome further clarity on that in the paper that will be published in 2023. We look forward to participating in that as well. If I move on then to the CGT annual exclusion, we thank SARS for the indication that their systems will be ready to cater for this change. Not only will this change then help the current system as it is, plus the new proposed changes, it will help fix the current problems that we're experiencing. So that's good news that the systems will be ready in that regard. Also touching on the contributed tax capital, thank you for excluding from that definition, we understand from the proposal, the legitimate targeted transactions, that they will now not be impacted, and hopefully we won't be in the same scenario or situation that we were last year, where we had to come to Parliament after the bill was changed to try and fix it. But we do appreciate National Treasury taking our concerns into account in that regard. On the TAA side, the Tax Administration Act, we are happy with the understatement penalties for the ETI. Thank you for those changes. On the tax clearance certificate or status, thank you, France, on that. Our concern was, yes, that this could be, you know, SARS can just question the tax clearance certificate where individuals or companies submit these null returns. It is concerning that there could be abuse, and we therefore do accept the that it is at least a senior SARS official that will be given that final decision. That does help us to some extent to alleviate our concerns. The one thing that just wasn't mentioned, and I do want to highlight it again, there are proposals that IRBA will no longer be a recognised controlling body. We again reiterate our concern that the Legal Professional Council is the only one that will then remain and will not be subject to all the other requirements that the rest of the RCBs will be subject to. And we're just again saying that this is just not just and equitable in the treatment so as far as all the other RCBs, and we do hope that National Treasury and SARS will look at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sharon, Saika. Busa? Busa, are you here on the platform? Alan Duty, do we have Busa on the platform? It doesn't look like. Let's proceed. Banking Association, South Africa.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, and thank you again for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of BASA. We did note in the National Treasury response that they did not address the collateral legislation, which we did speak about at the prior parliamentary session, which is understandable because no changes were made in the 2022 draft bills. However, given the fact that the only possible mechanism to postpone or amend this legislation further is by means of an amendment to the 2022 draft bill. And we are still under the impression that further consultation will take place between industry and National Treasury as well as SARS. We again appeal just to reconsider within this draft bill to postpone the effective date. Again, I just want to reiterate, we do support National Treasury's need to clarify that compliant reuse will result in taxes. However, the 2021 TAA legislation, which has been tabled at Parliament, will come into effect at the moment on 1 January 2023. And we consider the legislation to be detrimental to market liquidity, and we would like to please still engage with National Treasury further. The amendment as it stands at the moment, it constrains the amount of eligible collateral that we have in the market, and it also increases the cost of maintaining market liquidity, and the cost is really just as a result of the tax cost that will be levied. There's a very simple solution to correcting the 2021 Tax Amendment Act, and that is just by including the proposal that National Treasury made as a proviso as opposed to an exclusion. But like mentioned, we would love to engage with National Treasury on this matter further and therefore just request a postponement of the effective date within the draft 2022 tax bills. Thank you.
Thanks, Banking Association, BSA. PwC.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just going to concentrate on one aspect, and that's the carbon tax. there was obviously a huge amount to absorb in that hour-long presentation from Treasury, or in terms of their responses. So I think you just need to take that for what it is, and understand that we've had a limited opportunity to absorb what Treasury has said in that regard, and accordingly to provide an effective response to that off the cuff. That said, I think there are two aspects around the carbon tax that I just want to focus on. The one is around the allowances, and importantly, that boils down to what the effective carbon tax rates are. As Treasury themselves alluded to, that is the critical aspect that needs to be focused on, rather than simply the headline tax rates in isolation. With that in mind, it is a concern that there are still there's still uncertainty around the future trajectory, if you like, of the various allowances in question. Whilst noted that Treasury have indicated that there will be a paper issued in 2023 for further consultation, so far as that's concerned, it must be appreciated that that just adds to policy uncertainty, which is anathema to investment and growth in the economy. So it is certainly not ideal, and this piecemeal approach to carbon tax policy is entirely unhelpful from that perspective. The second aspect that I want to deal with is the revenue recycling. So the Treasury has provided a fairly detailed response to that and to the concerns that were raised from a revenue recycling perspective. I do want to highlight just a few aspects, because in some respects that response is misleading. The first thing I want to do is just reiterate that the amount of tax revenue that Treasury is raising on an annual basis, as we currently sit, is in the region of 3.5 billion rand. That is cash in the bank account that we're talking about. So to then suggest that things like the renewable energy premium and the electricity levy constitute the recycling of revenues insofar as that's concerned is blatantly incorrect. Those amounts that are that ESCOM would otherwise be liable from a carbon tax perspective do not reach Treasury's bank accounts at all. So that's the first aspect that you just need to be aware of. That's a little bit misleading. The other thing just to bear in mind around revenue recycling and some of the measures that Treasury highlighted is that many of them, to my knowledge, do not or no longer and have never potentially in some respects ever existed. So to my knowledge, things like the solar water geyser support, well, ESCOM withdrew that in 2019, and I'm not aware that there's any current existing solar water geyser subsidy in place. So the transparency is lacking in that regard, and what we really need to see is the rand and cents in terms of how those revenues have been recycled. I think as I alluded to last time when we presented, the electricity, the energy efficiency savings tax incentive is negligible in the greater scheme of things. In the 2019-20 fiscal year, that amounted to only 120 million rand. And just to highlight, that is the only measure that has been whereby the revenues are being recycled to business. To the extent that the others exist, those are being recycled to households rather than back to business itself. Two other points I just want to highlight insofar as the revenue recycling is concerned. Again, as I reiterated in my previous presentation.
Hello, Tyler. Have you realized that we don't have much time today?
Chair, if you'll just bear with me, just 2 points I want to make. And bear in mind that we were 3 minutes to respond to, as I said, to an hour-long presentation that Treasury made.
Please, so that the other stakeholders don't complain.
No, understood, Chair. So what I want to highlight, again, is the importance of the revenue cycling insofar as the economic modelling was concerned. Again, Treasury have highlighted themselves. And I just want to point you to one aspect, Joan, and that is the socioeconomic impact assessment study that accompanied the carbon tax bill in 2019. And I'm going to quote from it because Treasury themselves highlighted the following risk. And that says that the risk is one of the risks is the revenue recycling is not as high as anticipated, leading to a net transfer of income from business without compensation and a consequent decline in investment and growth. Well, frankly, as it would seem, that risk has actually materialized. What was Treasury's mitigating measure? Well, they said that they would review after phase one, the revenue recycling after phase one to determine its impact and how allowances, incentives, and tax rates could be changed to have an impact. Well, we are in effect at the end of the original phase one, and that review has not happened. So it's crucial that that review actually takes place and that the revenue recycling measures be revisited. Thank you, Chair. I'll leave it at that. Thanks for bearing with me.
Okay, thanks, Kyla.
Chair, it's Alan. Sorry to interject, but Happy Kambule from Busa is back on the line. He had connectivity issues. And also, just to note that SAB presented immediately after PwC last week, so I made a mistake on the agenda by putting them last. Thanks, Chair.
SAB, Broad.
Yes, Chair, the South African Brewery. So they present immediately, or they provide feedback immediately after SAB, but then Busa is back online now, and they missed the opportunity just before Carl spoke.
Okay. Busa, are you there?
Yes, Chair, I'm here, Chair.
Okay, 3 minutes.
Okay, Chair, and please do excuse me that I joined a bit late. I had those problems. Chair, I think we need to be clear, and I'm a bit worried with some of the rationale that the National Treasury has put forward. But at least from our side, what we can say is that we support the fact that this is part of climate action and that the reductions that we are seeking, at least in terms of the relationship between the carbon tax and the mitigation outcomes that South Africa needs to get, need to be clearly spelled out. And I think some of what Carl from PwC also indicates is that we still need to undertake a particular review of how effective the actual tax has been implemented so that we know where the likely unintended consequences are being held. And obviously, Chair, we welcome the fact that Treasury is encouraging the bottom-up analysis, and we hope that Treasury will be joining us in hand and in step in order to determine the likely parameters and to also share in the outcomes of that particular study. So we want to do that in concert with them. I just want to say, Chair, that the fact that we do have certain opposition and questions around the proposal does not mean that we are not in line with the Paris Agreement outcomes or the country's mitigation commitments. But what we're trying to do here is to indicate and clearly communicate the issues of affordability and the number of challenges that we are faced with. Chair, if you can permit me, Chair, I think we still need to have that conversation about what happens to applying a tax above the carbon budgets and within carbon budgets and what that means in terms of the realization that there could be double penalties or jeopardy that is applied. But we are happy to have that conversation post TLAB and ensuring that the second phase is at least in line with what we all agree to. Chair, if it is possible, I don't want to take even more time. I would allow my colleagues from Busa, who are members, to also jump in, and we will share a written response to what the Treasury has put forward. But we are happy with some of the responses that have been shared. Over, Chair.
Thanks, Busa. Ruwale, are you there?
Morning, Chair, and morning, MPs. I would just like to raise 3 points with regards to National Treasury's response to our submission. Firstly, in line with our ask for a consistent basis on which all our categories are taxed
excise. National Treasury has responded by sharing market volume data, as well as the relative alcohol content contribution of each alcohol category within the industry. I would like to highlight, Chair, that this is contrary to what public health research has stated, that the higher the alcohol content, the higher the alcohol industry player should be taxed. For instance, the market share of the spirits category is 3%, whilst the beer industry is 75%, as quoted by the National Treasury. But in respect to this, the spirits industry is taxed double the excise tax that the beer industry is paying, because the average ABV is around 40%. However, Chair, we experience and note the wine industry on average has 12% ABV, but is paying lower taxes amounting to four times less than the beer industry. And this is the inconsistencies within the excise framework that hasn't been materially dealt with in terms of National Treasury's response. We do think fundamentally that there is a scope and a best practice around this, and Treasury needs to note this outside of market share and alcohol content volume relative to each alcohol player. We also note, Chair, that within the draft report, the National Treasury only quotes data provided by the wine industry in its empirical evidence. As an industry, we have given Treasury multiple opportunities and submissions to use our data and our models to guide a transparent process around excise policy. We, however, haven't got an opportunity to do this, and we think this is a gap noted in giving the industry insofar space to contribute to excise-based discussions. Secondly, Chair, I would like to point to the empirical evidence provided by National Treasury around giving the wine industry preferential treatment within the excise policy. National Treasury has quoted the fact that in the EU, wine countries are giving, wine-producing countries are giving the wine industry preferential treatment. This is different, Chair, to the response that National Treasury had given in February post the budget during those public hearings, in which they quoted page 57 of the excise policy, stating that it is the macroeconomic performance of the wine industry that grants it preferential treatment. So we just need clarity, Chair, as to why this reason has changed. In addition to this, we would like to note that National Treasury needs to apply the excise policy to the South African context. The merits of an alcohol content-based system have not been tested by the National Treasury in their response, and this is something that we would ask them to do as part of the draft rates tax amendment bill process. Lastly, Chair, there is a point around certainty that the National Treasury responded to. We have not asked, as a beer industry and as a business, that National Treasury does not use guidelines to guide the excise adjustment. Rather, Chair, we've asked for a remedy for the lack of a certainty and predictability in the excise adjustment. In that regard, Chair, we have asked that the medium-term budget be a space in which business is given an opportunity to get certainty for investments and business planning by fixing the excise rate in line with forecasted inflation into the medium term. Thank you, Chair. Those are the 3 points I would like to raise in response to the excise adjustment.
Thanks, SAP. WWF.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief, I think. WWF and our social partners are very happy to see that Treasury is holding the ground on the carbon tax rates. We still maintain that the rates as being much lower than globally and locally modeled recommendations for effective tax rates for developing nations are very much the low ground for the just transition. And we agree they're an effective tool in incentivizing the transition. So we strongly support the strengthening and consideration of science-aligned increases in the carbon tax rate going forward, given the critical nature of the tool. With respect to the extension of tax deductions on the basis of saw milling activities and other sectors, I'd just like to reiterate the caution that we've provided that with the continued failure to include the AFOLU sector within the tax net, there's a significant risk of expanding potential emissions nationally with this process, since we don't include the long-term changes in standing biomass relating to the sequestration. So for this reason, we propose that sequestration activities be considered under the offsets allowance and limited in that regard. We also look forward to the participation in the tax-free allowance debate going forward. We strongly recommend a more rapid phase out of the basic allowance, but the consideration of limiting those allowances to developmentally critical, hard to abate sectors and subsequent phases. Thank you.
Thanks, James, for being so brief but to the point. Sasla?
Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, thanks for this opportunity. As was disappointed that the collateral arrangement definition was not included in the feedback from National Treasury, however, we would like to restate our concerns. The proposed amendments to the collateral definition currently proposed is drafted in such a way that the limitation of reuse of collateral forms part of the exceptions to the collateral arrangement dispensation. This has an unintended consequence of excluding all preceding compliant collateral arrangements in a collateral change, instead of only subjecting any non-compliant collateral arrangements. It's therefore our submission that if the reuse of collateral prohibition is included as a proviso instead of as part of the exceptions to the definition, it would have the required effect of clarifying that any arrangement that fails to meet the collateral arrangement definition would not benefit from STT or CDT dispensation, but ensures that any prior compliant collateral arrangement on the same securities will benefit from the dispensation. The industry is very concerned that if the TLAB is not amended as suggested, that we would see market participants in the South African financial markets be forced to either use cash collateral or revert back to the pledge mechanism via cession in securitized and debit with no rights of reuse. This would be because market participants would want to avoid the unknown and costly impact of STT and CGT. In both these instances, this will cause a liquidity squeeze within the market, and this could destabilize the financial markets. This may also deter international entities participating in our SFT and derivative markets. In addition, if the TLAB amendment proceeds without any amendment, then this will coincide with the Joint Standard 2 of the 2020 FSR Act and may exacerbate the liquidity crisis. The Joint Standard 2 is a requirement for mandatory collateral in the form of initial margin and variation margin to be posted between parties in OTC derivatives. Both the PA and the FSCA have noted this liquidity risk and have released a recent paper on changing acceptable collateral because of their worries. We do note that National Treasury has agreed to a workshop with the financial markets on this issue in Q4. However, SASLA is aware there is no legislative mechanism to amend or postpone the 2021 legislation, and thus we are worried that the current definition will be implemented on the 1st of January, even if there's further discussions with National Treasury. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Michael. And then let's move to Sasson.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Andre Rosoya from SASL. Thank you for the opportunity to provide some brief comments in reaction. I also thank the committee and National Treasury for the really constructive engagement. I'm going to make three comments. Firstly, although I don't like being called a turkey, let's talk turkey. I think I like the saying Turkey's not voting for Christmas, but I could never understand what are the turkeys voting for. And we're exactly in this position that there's no clarity in the proposal around the allowances, which makes it impossible really to understand the potential impact of the proposed changes to the carbon tax. So despite the commitments or promises of further engagement, a paper being published in 2023, it would be irresponsible to enact changes to the tax legislation before nailing down the allowances. And I think we certainly beg that these allowances aspect is clarified before these changes are enacted. I think secondly, it is we would certainly ask for a little bit of transparency and perhaps honesty in the international benchmarking of South Africa's carbon taxes. I think it is intellectually insulting that there are specific aspects picked when presenting global benchmarks. I see nine countries handpicked to show a path. Let's be clear, if one looks at those international development slides, most of the other carbon taxes referenced are either on specific portions of the economy, it's either proposed or exploring. The reality, despite the fact that we are referencing the US dollar, the United States does not have any carbon tax. India does not have a carbon tax. China does not have an explicit carbon tax. Brazil does not have a carbon tax. Russia does not have a carbon tax. And I think we've got to have an honest conversation around what's going to be the competitive impact of South African industry relative to other global industries if these significant increases are enacted. And let's be clear about that. I think just lastly, when it comes to this point as well, we keep referencing the EU, and certainly the EU has higher taxes, but they have carbon border adjustments. We are now implementing significant increases that is certainly world leading, and we've certainly proposed a transition, but without border adjustments for South Africa, it's going to be significantly detrimental to the competitiveness of industry in South Africa. Chair, I want to conclude there just also to note that SASL is absolutely committed to a transition. We don't oppose carbon tax to the extent that it forms part of well-considered regulations to do it, and SASL is already doing significant work to transition our company, but also form an important role in the transitioning of South Africa. And we thank you for the ongoing debate around these aspects. Thank you.
Thanks, Sasol. Minerals Council.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, and also the participants. Thank you very much for the opportunity to respond on behalf of the Minerals Council of Africa. Just maybe as a matter of principle for us to extend or to reiterate our commitment to climate action and also commitment to a just energy transition, and also to indicate that the fact that we have raised some concerns around various aspects that have been amended through the TLAP, specifically on the Carbon Tax Act, that does not constitute to lack of leadership or action on climate change issues. And with that, also to indicate our support to the long-term goals and actions that are set through the Paris Agreement, Glasgow Climate Pact, and a whole lot of other initiatives under the UN Convention on Climate Change that are aimed at reducing the impact of climate change. And further to reiterate our commitment to continuing to contribute to South Africa's response through the implementation of various policies, instruments, and measures aimed at reaching the net zero. And that would also include the act that we are discussing today, which is the Carbon Tax Act. And lastly, just to reiterate the fact that we acknowledge that the importance of carbon markets mechanism in the form of carbon tax. However, we are concerned about the dire socioeconomic implication of the proposed high tax rate, and we note with deep concern that our proposals around the proposed high carbon tax rate have not been taken into consideration, and we still maintain that this will have quite dire negative implications for the continuation of certain mining operations. In conclusion, maybe just to also note and acknowledge some clarification that has been given by National Treasury around the basic tax-free allowance on the continuation of this in the short term. However, we still maintain that we need some clarification or surety on the existence of this in the long term. There was also some clarification around the alignment between the carbon tax and the carbon budget, wherein we feel that we need further information to this, especially more info around the nature of allowances or the nature of the actual alignment between the two instruments, especially pertaining to the accession on the tax above the budget and also the tax below the budget. I think further conversation is required on this for us to understand better the implications on this. I will end here, Chair, and give my colleague Bongani to just say a word of you. Thanks.
But you know you have got 3 minutes, isn't it, Minerals Council?
It's just 1 minute intervention, Chair.
And thank you, Chair. And mine will just take less than a minute. There are two points that I want to basically raise. The first one is the fact that certainly this will have a cost escalating impact on the industry. And one of the challenges that we have as mining is cost containment. And this fact, the fact that we cannot transfer cost increases to the final price of what we sell. And that's a big problem for us. And it takes me to the second and last point. Now, the mining industry has lost thousands of jobs, and it's not because of a lack of commercially exploitable reserves in South Africa. In fact, speaking specifically to the gold industry, the gold industry has lost 48,000 jobs in the last 10 years. And this is despite the fact that we are ranked number 5 globally as the country with the most gold reserves. So most of our mines in the gold mining industry are much mines. So when a slight increase in cost results in mainly two things, at least two things, job losses and also closure of mining operations. I think the last point that I want to talk about is that the ferrochrome industry will really suffer because of this. It's one industry that really is sensitive to cost increases mainly because of electricity increases, but also because of competition from China. But indeed the carbon tax will have their consequences for the industry. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Minerals Council. Cement, South Africa. Cement and concrete, South Africa.
Thank you, and good morning, Honorary Chair and members. I trust you can hear me. I'll give you a few quick brief comments. The CCSA, we'd thank the Steering Committee and the National Treasury team for the comprehensive feedback provided on comments submitted on carbon tax. We believe that we would still need some time to review the presentation to better understand implications. However, some quick comments. I think, first of all, the certainty clarity on the conversion from USD to ZAR, this is really appreciated. In the case of allowances, we note that there's still no clarity on future extent of allowances. In the interim, our members would still be facing uncertainty in terms of effective rates and their business sustainability. The cement sector is quite stressed in terms of business at present. However, the CCL looks forward to engaging on the design of allowances proposed for commencement in 2023. So that's with regards to the allowances. In terms of trade exposure, cement, unlike many other commodities, is trade exposed based on cheap imports rather than us exporting cement. So while there's a lot of reference made to exports to EU, we certainly are concerned that we may face even more cheaper imports coming in from those industries that will face challenges to export to EU as a result of the border tax adjustments. So I think this trade exposure needs to be taken into account for the cement sector in terms of imports. then in terms of recycling of revenue, our members would still be concerned on the approach to revenue recycling based on the presentation. And I think you have heard some comments from the Banking Association, and we believe that revenue recycling requires a bit more work to better inform future tax regime. Then in terms of penalties and carbon budgets and carbon tax, we believe there's still some uncertainty with regards to carbon tax above budget and the approach to penalties. You know, the alignment of carbon tax and carbon budget requires much clarity, and we hope that this would come forth quite soon now with the development of the climate change bill. Finally, I think we'd like to thank the members who listened carefully to our comments, and we'd like to express that we are committed to responding positively to climate change and a just transition. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Simon. SA, Industry Trust Team on Climate Change.
Thank you, Chair. The Industry Task Team on Climate Change appreciates the efforts made by all role players to decarbonize and transition South Africa. We also appreciate the detailed feedback provided by National Treasury throughout the whole consultation process, and it really helps to understand the reasoning behind everything. We would therefore like to affirm that providing information on what the potential impacts of a carbon tax will be does not mean that we are against it or the country's goals to achieve the Paris Agreement targets, but it does have an effective impact on the operations and livelihoods of all companies and the public in general. We welcome the adoption of a rand-denominated tax rate, as that provides some clarity as to how we can look forward to future carbon taxes and the pricing signals, as well as the clarity on the allowances. And we will definitely be participating in the consultation sessions once the paper is released. Then we further fully support the work being done on the mitigation potential analysis. However, we still suggest that the economic impact and the incentives and their respective impact should be reconsidered and expanded on to promote this just transition in an affordable way. And the main reason for that is that the studies mentioned by National Treasury was performed with assumptions that has changed. As an example, the economic impact study that looked at the different tax rates that showed South Africa will reach the reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, as well as looking at the different methods to recycle the tax, was still based on the Integrated Resource Plan for 2030. The Integrated Resource Plan has been updated subsequently, and other factors such as COVID came into effect that's not included in any of those economic analyses. I will end by saying that we agree that low-hanging fruit should be harvested, but if you do not have the correct tools to harvest the fruit, the impact over the long run will be minimum, and thereby saying that without the necessary support, incentives, and the correct structure, we won't be able to reach any of the goals that we set out to achieve. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Industry Trust Team and climate Change. Chemical and Allied Industry Association.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair, and to the Honourable members. We are very glad to be able to have this opportunity to present our initial reactions to the responses by the National Treasury this morning. Firstly, we're very glad that the National Treasury has recommitted to engage on the future design of the carbon tax, and we look forward to that, Chair. We just feel that it's very, very important that this gets underway as soon as possible so that industry can appropriately consider the future and the potential financial implications it may face, Chair. Secondly, the continuation of the rates of the base rate of the carbon tax is very worrying, Chair. Taken, for instance, with the statement by the National Treasury of them not having significant impact on companies. CAIA submitted in its written submission as well as in its oral submission extensive examples of how its member companies were trying to consider the financial impact of the tax, and it was dire. So we really do need to take cognizance of that going forward as well. The statement, Chair, that there's no leadership from business, we find quite concerning, given that in the chemical industry there are companies operating best in class. From a global perspective, there has been voluntary greenhouse gas emissions mitigation for a number of years, up to a decade and more. So business as usual, Chair, for the chemical industry generally has not been one of not doing anything, but really doing what was feasible all along through voluntary mitigation. Next, I would really like to make the point, Chair, that we really need a single mitigation system on the table for further engagement. There are a number of policy matters outstanding, and there is still uncertainty in the market. We may have assumed about the very fast reduction of allowances, but we don't really have a choice in this matter to determine bookends with which to work from. And the statement in the slide saying that the carbon budget and set methodologies have already been approved is news to us, Chair, as we consider them still being developed and still under engagement. So, Chair, we really do feel as well that the continued implementation of the carbon tax on on most members of our sector is implementation of the polluter pays principle, and we really call for a strong consideration of absolute flexibility in carbon offsetting and ring fencing of the revenue, Chair, going forward, so that we can ensure that all possible greenhouse gas emissions can be reduced wherever that may be possible. CAIA has been involved in general environmental offsetting discussions since 2015, Chair, where we've been calling for appropriate offsetting principles that are unique for the South African circumstance, and we hope that this can now be taken forward 7 years later. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Chemical and Allied Industrial Association. Asal Mittal.
Thank you. Good morning, Honourable Chairman and Honourable Members of the Committee. Can you all hear me? I'm having some connectivity problems. Okay. Also, many thanks for Treasury for submitting the feedback on our comments. But in general, we feel that our comments were not taken seriously. I think, first of all, just to comment on the slides that were presented by National Treasury, and Sossel also referred to the slide 36 of the Treasury presentation that focuses on international developments. Here, a list of countries are listed where carbon pricing has been implemented. But, and this is one of the focus points of our response that was submitted and the slides that were presented during the presentations made on the 12th. What is not said is that the quoted or proclaimed carbon price is not the carbon price that is necessarily being paid in the end. A country like Mexico is mentioned where carbon pricing has been implemented. Just remember that this is a natural gas-based economy, and natural gas is exempted from carbon tax in Mexico. The same for Argentina. A carbon price is implemented, but the iron and steel sector and various other energy-intensive sectors are excluded from the carbon pricing regime in Argentina. And so we can go on. So we humbly request that National Treasury does more homework in this regard, besides for just quoting international carbon prices. I think further also, we do welcome the initiative and the promise that further work will be done in terms of the allowances going forward. But we have to state that this is simply not good enough. First of all, we sit with an announcement by the minister made in February that the tax-free allowances will be rapidly phased out from 2026 onwards. Now we sit with a promise that, yes, we will look into it again. And quite frankly, the uncertainty is killing us. We respectfully submit that you cannot have high carbon prices promulgated without supplying clarity on the allowances. To be promised that it will be looked into, that is simply not good enough. And then we wonder why deindustrialization is taking place in our country. Lastly, Honorable Chair, the fact of imports, steel imports specifically, as raised in our comments, is not addressed. Our sector is seeing a lot of steel being imported into our country from jurisdictions where no price or only a low price is being levied on carbon. Imports amount to roughly 50% of local consumption. Steel is also found in many finished goods with no carbon price being considered. With the proposed increase in carbon prices, our competitiveness is severely compromised. Carbon prices must need to be implemented cautiously till a broader implementation of carbon prices is witnessed globally. Protectionist measures like carbon border adjustments could be an option, and which are being debated in various jurisdictions globally. But based on the presentation, it seems that National Treasury is shying away from this debate. And we need import protection, Honorable Chairman. I think having said all these things, my time is probably up. But just to conclude, I think we remain a very concerned sector. Iron and steel is a hard-to-abate sector. We welcome some of the initiatives that are launched, but we trust that the TLAB in its current form will not be promulgated and that provision for the allowances will be included in this version already. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Dr. Mittal. Now it's time for committee members to make comments, ask clarity, seeking questions. There we are, members of the committee. Are there clarity seeking questions? Are there comments from members? More younger, the stakeholders here are saying that they are not opposed to the carbon tax, but the manner in which it is introduced, it will be difficult for them to afford. It's the same question that was raised last time when we were discussing the FATF stuff. So it is raised again today. It's a matter that you will have to attend to, so that it should not be like we don't take what the industry is raising or the stakeholders are raising, and later we come back and say, no, we should have done it differently. While waiting for members, or if not, with 7 minutes left, Momo Yanga, do you like to attend to the issue of affordability raised by stakeholders? Because I think that's an issue that is cutting across almost all the participants. Momo Yanga, are you there?
Yeah, I was.
Koronilele.
Hi, Chair. I was looking. I thought Momo is still in, but he said he's got another engagement. I think that issue, Ushalin has touched on it during the presentation, but I'll hand over to Shalin to respond to that. Shalin?
Thanks, Yanga, and thanks, Chair, and to everybody for the comments that have been provided. I think it's very useful for us going forward. Chair, the one thing we struggled with in the process to date on the information provided by industry was the assessment of the financial impact of the carbon tax based on the current proposals. So it seems that the assessment of the financial impacts assumed that there will be no allowances in 2030. And Chair, this is highly unlikely to be the case. As we've mentioned, we will be engaging further with the stakeholders on the future design of the allowances that are currently in place. We will have to take into account the hard-to-abate sectors, in particular the sectors that were mentioned around iron and steel, cement, the chemicals sector, in terms of the transition and the availability of technologies. And the issue is that this is an ever-evolving space that we are in. And the requirements in terms of our climate and greenhouse gas emissions commitments will be coming much more stringent going forward. But we need to balance that with the impact on the industry. So overall, from our assessment of the financial impacts on industry, it's significantly less than the numbers that have been put forward there. And it would be useful for us to engage the industry further. I think the two issues that were raised around the future of the allowances, currently the TLAB did not propose any changes to the allowances. At this stage, the allowances are in place and they do not have an end date. So until there are further engagements around this and proposals are made, the allowances are still in place in principle there. I think the second issue is that in the assessments that were done, the analysis took into account the direct impacts on the carbon tax for Scope 1 emissions, which is the impacts from electricity generation, the process emitters that are there. But it also took into account a pass-through of the carbon tax through the electricity levy in 2026. As we've mentioned in our response, we will be doing further work on the impacts on the industry due to the inclusion of the carbon tax in the electricity sector and the impacts. But at this stage, we've proposed that this the commitment to electricity price neutrality is extended for a 3 to 5 year period, and this will be subject to consultation. So currently, it has been extended to 2025, and this should, if it's extended further, it will provide relief to the industry in terms of the transition. This will also take into account the transition of the electricity sector that is underway in terms of the shifting to alternative energy, which would make certain technologies more viable over the medium to longer term, especially for the hard-to-abate sectors there. I think maybe lastly from my side, and I think Chris, you can come in.
There have been comments around the revenue recycling measures that have been outlined and the support that has been provided and a request that this is extended, as well as comments around the international comparisons that have been put forward. On the revenue recycling measures, usually we do not support earmarking of revenues because this introduces rigidities into the budget process, and it could result in less revenue being allocated for particular priority programs than is actually required. So the approach we took with the carbon tax was to look at soft earmarking of some of the revenues through this commitment around electricity price neutrality, as well as the energy efficiency savings tax incentive. In addition to that, there are on-budget programs that do exist related to environment-related programs around the Working for Water, Working for Energy programs that are in place. I think on this, it would be useful if the industry can submit proposals around the type of programs that could be supported going forward. Our estimates of the carbon tax in terms of the revenues that could be that was raised from the tax is we've for the period 2019 to 2020 the revenues from the tax was basically 2 billion rands. There was a number provided of 3.5 billion. I'm not sure about the source of that, but that revenue is far less than the revenue that that could be channeled around supporting a just transition and especially around supporting new industries and supporting workers and communities. There is already work underway through the PCC around the just transition framework, around supporting the transition of the electricity sector, and further work is planned for the other sectors that would be impacted. So it would be useful to have more an engagement broadly in terms of the transition and what kind of support would be required on that. On the international comparison, Chair, that is just an example of some of the taxes that are in place, and as well as the emissions trading schemes that are in place. It doesn't take into account the other policies that these countries are implementing and looking at implementing in terms of reducing their emissions, transitioning their industrial sectors, as well as transitioning their electricity sector. And I think if once you look at that broadly, there's a firm commitment around the transition in those various countries. In the case of China, it has put in place an emissions trading scheme, but it also has in place a range of environmental pollution charges and taxes that are also implemented within that system. I think I'll stop there. I don't know if Chris Younger, you want to come in.
Yeah, I'll just be very, very quick. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. You know, in the 2022 budget, we actually extended the first phase of the carbon tax, which a lot of NGOs and others says we're being far too soft on businesses because we were extending the allowances, we're extending the electricity price neutrality, we're extending the incentives for this. So, you know, times have certainly changed where it wasn't that long ago where we were being too soft, but now, you know, industry are saying we're being far too hard. And the rates are going up, but because we haven't mentioned what the allowances are doing, we haven't put it in legislation what the allowances are doing, I don't think that's enough of a reason not for us not to go ahead with the higher rates. We do need the higher rates. The rate is incredibly low, and we always said that we would put in the carbon tax at a very, very low rate and have this long, gradual increase to give industry time to adjust to this new rate that will come in the future. So we didn't want to hurt them immediately, but industries do need to adjust, which is why we had that long increase in the rate. And we haven't legislated any reductions in the allowances, so we do want to have further consultations. You know, there is this level of uncertainty, and I think the view of the statement in the budget was taken far too literally that it will be phased out immediately by 2030. So we can have those consultations. There's always uncertainty with any tax going forward, but we want to try and be consult, have lots of consultations on this. And we try to be very transparent. I didn't really appreciate some of the comments to say that we were either misleading by PwC or that we weren't being transparent. We put all our numbers out, we try and have these conversations. In terms of the revenue recycling, I don't think there is a specific statement anywhere that we will fully revenue recycle all these carbon tax, but we do try and do it, and we've done it through that energy efficiency savings tax incentive. I think it's actually misleading on PwC to only quote the last year, which doesn't include all the returns. So if you look at the full value of the revenue lost from the energy efficiency savings tax incentive, that's about 3.7 billion. But the full revenue that we've gained from the carbon tax is about 1.9 billion. So the amount that we've actually given back through revenue forgone in the incentive is far higher than actual carbon tax that we've collected. So I'd like to know where exactly we are being misleading on those. But we do have, we are happy to have those consultations, and we will have them throughout the year. And we will take into consideration all these impacts on these industries, but also the need for South Africa to meet their nationally determined contribution and actually try and reduce those emissions. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thanks, National Treasury, SARS, for that response. Let's move to the next and the last item of closure. From here, we'll take the report, the process forward. The committee will deliver. Dr. George, before we close, are you raising your hand?
Yes, Chair. I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I just wanted to ask the question. It's been 2.5 years since we've had a face-to-face meeting, and I know a number of committees are, in fact, returning to Parliament. And I just wanted to suggest that we should start considering restarting our meetings again in Parliament rather than virtually. I know that there are logistical issues, but I did want to put that onto the table. Thanks, Chair, for the opportunity.
Thanks, Dr. George. The speaker, and I'm not sure whether it's Whip Party or the Whips Forum, are attending to this matter of venues being available for the sittings or plenary, as well as the committees. So it will be looked at in that context. So the Secretariat of the committee and the Speaker's Office, and whosoever deals with the issue of venues, will look at it and we take it from there. Thanks. Thanks very much. From here, we'll process the report as the committee and then take it to the National Assembly. Thanks very much to the stakeholders, to members, media, all in attendance. The meeting is officially closed. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Recording stopped.